Good to see everybody back. Let's just take a really brief time to arrive, to settle into a comfortable posture. Bring the attention to the gates of the senses, what we can see, what we can hear, smell, taste, totality of our ocean of felt somatic bodily sensations. Pick up the rhythm of the breath in the body. Just rest there for a while, still in body, speech and mind, with the senses vividly alive. Allowing mind and body to settle into the natural state, relaxed but alert. And in that quieter space to set up our motivation. Take safe direction from the three jewels and make a deep wish to gain liberation from cyclic existence, realize full enlightenment, not just for ourselves alone, but for the benefit of all sentient beings. Sangye Chodang Soki Chonam La Changchu Badu Dakni Kyabzu Shi Dage Chunyen Gipe Sonam Gi Drola Panchir Sangye Drupa Zhu Sangye Chodang Soki Chonam La Changchu Badu Dakni Kyabzu Shi Dage chunyen gipe sonam gi drola panchir sangye drupa jo. I take refuge until I'm enlightened in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits of generosity and so forth, may I become a Buddha to benefit transmigratory beings. Thank you very much. And in that spirit, let's engage into the topic. As I said, this is there's a kind of a central text here, but we're not just staying with the text or working through it in a parrot fashion by His Holiness, called How to See Yourselves as You Really Are. But I'll use it and quote from it as we go along. And really the starting point here is right back to the first teaching of the Buddha and to the first and second noble truth. It really always involves the four noble truths, but the focus here is on the origin of suffering, if you like. And if you remember, in the center of the depiction, the tanka or the icon of the wheel of life, there is the cockerel, the pig and the snake chasing one another's tails, driving the wheel, driving cyclic existence. And these three represent greed, hatred, and ignorance. And the ignorance, as we often have to keep reminding ourselves because of the English into which it's translated, the ignorance is not one of being ill-mannered or uneducated in any way. It's got none of those connotations. It's the ignorance of taking things to exist in the way they appear. And because we take things to exist in the way they appear, or attribute to them an existence that they don't really have, that on that basis we make choices, decisions, and act out of attachments and aversions, which are in the first place dependent upon what is something of an illusion. Because it's all done habitually, mechanically, in a very conditioned way, by way of reaction rather than response, because the underlying assumption is things actually exist in the way they appear to us when they don't. So it's looking for insight into the nature of that appearance reality distinction and beginning to see that things don't quite exist in the way that they appear. And perhaps importantly, if we want to make it really, really simple, they're not as concrete as we normally think they are. You know, there's this kind of assumption that that reality is very hard, very concrete, that things last forever. We underestimate change, and so on. So where we're going here is to have some insight into the nature of that rather illusory appearance, and looking primarily or first at what that means for us. Who are we? You know, to what does the I refer? Because we often have a very kind of assumed and rather sure view that, you know, we're singular, permanent, partless, in a certain sense, unchanging. And, you know, in our most extreme delusion, even possibly immortal. So starting to look at that, which is the basis of getting to see how we really are, you start to think about appearance and reality generally in this way, and think, since the mind can only work directly with that which appears in experience via the five senses and mental consciousness, it has to build up a model. And that model is part perceptual and part conceptual of, you know, that which exists behind or beyond appearances. And this is, of course, just a conceptual construction, but it's one of such usefulness, you know, in survival and other terms, that it stays with us throughout our lives, and indeed may even be very important to our functioning. But the problem is, if we don't see it for what it is, but assume that it exists in a different way, then it becomes problematic. So one of the radical aspects of the Buddha's teaching and Buddhist meditation as a practice is that it invites us to suspend, if you like, the habit of kind of reflexively ascribing existence to everything experienced, and kind of return to initially to the perceptual simplicity of a more phenomenological view, just paying attention to what's actually there. And when we kind of attend merely to what appears, there's a very famous teaching according to the Bahiya Sutta in the Pali Canon, where the Buddha, in answering Bahiya, said, in the seen, there will just be the seen. In the heard, just the heard. In the felt, just the felt. And in the thought, just the thought. That's the Udana Sutta 110, the Bahiya. And even a kind of passing encounter with meditation will kind of demonstrate that it doesn't take long in this kind of modality of consciousness for the reality of the external world to dissolve into relative irrelevance amidst a kind of a swirling sea of ever-changing phenomena, you know, displayed out of the five senses and mental consciousness. And the appearances are so apparently real insofar as they arise and pass away with such kind of astonishing immediacy, that the question of whether they're not really real, as it were, becomes a mere kind of conceptual curiosity, more kind of distracting than meaningful. So back to our thinking about the three poisons again, you know, ignorance, attachment, and aversion. The first link of the 12 links of origination, on dependent origination, conditioned co-production on the wheel of life, it's not only in the middle depicted as the cock, the pig and the snake, with ignorance being depicted by the snake there, and this not only drives there, but if you come to the outside of the wheel, the first link going round clockwise, yeah, of those is ignorance, and then out of that comes consciousness and so on and so forth. And of those three, when you look at those three together, greed, hatred and ignorance, or attachment, aversion and ignorance, however, in whichever modality you want to see them, it's ignorance that really is the root poison. Because the other two, attachment and aversion, greed, hatred and so on, and all the emotional modalities of that, are dependent upon it. So the dualistic mind clings, craves or thirsts, tanha, that's the eighth link of the 12 links of dependent origination, and passion, aggression and delusion kind of result. They're movements in thought provoked by sort of habitual patterns of behavior. But it's ignorance that drives the entire process. You know, ignorance in this very specific sense, it's avidya in Sanskrit. So it's not just the inability to kind of apprehend the truth, but it's an active misapprehension of the status of ourselves and all other objects, you know, our mind, our body, other people, and so forth. And it's the conception or assumption that phenomena exist, as I was saying, in a far more concrete way than they actually.
Sorry, I think we've just lost Roy. We'll just need to wait for him to come back. Hopefully it'll not be too long.
Thank you. So we were talking in terms of, you know, it being ignorance that kind of drives the entire process. And that ignorance being, you know, one of our kind of active misapprehension of appearances, mistaking them for reality. And there's rather a nice quote from His Holiness in his book, The Meaning of Life, that's quite good here. His book, The Meaning of Life, actually on the Wheel of Life itself. And he says, based on misapprehension of the status of persons and things, we're drawn into afflictive desire and hatred, attachment and aversion, not knowing the real nature of the phenomena. We're driven to generate desire for what we like and hatred for what we don't like and for what blocks our desires. And these three, ignorance, desire and hatred, are called thus the three poisons, because they pervert our mental outlook. That's from Geoffrey Hopkins, The Meaning of Life. As I said, I'll give everybody a full bibliography, so don't worry if you don't catch the titles and where I'm sourcing things. I'll give everybody a full list at the end of the retreat. So if we sort of come forward from the teaching of the Buddha and think about the development of psychotherapy and psychoanalysis, and then cognitive science and neuroscience in the, you know, late 19th and into the 20th and 21st century, the kind of first wave of psychoanalysis, really, I suppose, the classical period of Freud and his followers, that kind of extended into the 1950s. And that was kind of primarily concerned with uncovering repressed desire or anger, or in the Greek sense of those terms, eros and thanatos. You know, the kind of life and death instincts, which in some way kind of correspond. There's a it's not precise, but there's a reasonable analogy there with the Buddhist ideas of attachment and aversion. And then in successive waves of the development of psychoanalysis, the kind of focus was on object relations and narcissism, and that's kind of dominated the last 30 years, really, of psychoanalytical theory. And that kind of exposed the gap within, you know, within ourselves, that feelings of emptiness, inauthenticity and alienation that results from a kind of an estrangement from how we really are, from our true selves, if you like, and our kind of confusion and ignorance about our own true natures. So in the Buddhist view, this really is the kind of the black pig of delusion or ignorance, and the root or precondition of greed and hatred, attachment and aversion. So I think that's if we're connecting with contemporary mind science, it's worthwhile thinking about that, you know, doing that comparison between the way psychotherapy and psychoanalysis developed post-Freud and looking at the Buddhist ideas of life and death instincts, attachment and aversion, and the elements of delusion involved. It's quite a fruitful way to have a look at things. So in the Buddhist sense, ignorance is kind of equivalent to the identification of a self as being separate from everything else. You know, here I am, everything else is other. And it kind of consists in a belief that there's an I that's somehow completely disconnected and not a part of anything else. And very often on that basis, we think, well, I'm one and I'm unique and everything else is not me. You know, it's something different. And from that kind of identification stems a very dualistic view, you know, since once there's an I, there are also others, and up to here is me and the rest is they. And as soon as we make that split, it kind of creates two opposite ways of reacting to it. You know, this is nice, I want it, and this is not nice, I don't want it, to kind of express it in very, very simple, if not too simplistic, a set of terms. But it's much more complex than that, but I think you get the idea. So I did quite recently was sort of chairing a discussion or a Q&A for Ringu Tulku, and he was sort of saying, you know, on the one hand there are those things that seem to threaten or undermine us. Maybe they harm us or take away our identity. We see them as a danger to our security. And due to that way of thinking, aversion arises. And then on the other hand, there are those things that, you know, we think are so nice. We think, oh, I want them. You know, we want them quite a lot. And through that way of thinking, attachment arises. So the main theme of this retreat will be to try and get a better, deeper, experiential understanding of how we falsely superimpose or project onto everything that appears a much more solid and concrete reality than it actually has or warrants. So it's not that the world is an illusion. It's quite important to understand that, although the appearance is illusion-like. Nor is it wholly a kind of an illusory reflection of consciousness, more akin to the objects of consciousness, ourselves and things in the world, or phenomena being kind of two manifestations of the same reality, kind of taking a non-dual view and rejecting, if you like, the two-ness of things, but at the same time, not just asserting that it's all the same, kind of acknowledging that reality, when we talk about reality, is kind of, it's ineffable. It's kind of beyond the dualistic conceptual elaborations or fabrications. So maybe another way of looking at it would be to say that there are at least not two. So appearance and reality are not posited as two completely different things with one transcending or somehow behind the other. Good to go back to the Heart Sutra here, because this is really rooted in the Prajnaparamita literature, and the core of the Heart Sutra the core of which itself is form is emptiness, and emptiness is form. Emptiness is not other than form, and form also is not other than emptiness. And in the same way, the body and the consciousness of the universe are similarly related. Yeah. And we began to also connect with the Pali idea on that wheel of the eight, the one of tanha, or craving, you know, holding on to pleasurable experiences, wanting to be separated from painful or unpleasant experiences, and wanting neutral experiences or feelings not to decline. So that kind of craving itself is to a degree bipolar in nature. You know, it's divided into greed and hatred, or passion and aggression. On the one hand, there's a desire to have something and possess it, to experience it, to pull it in, to own it. And on the other hand, there's the desire to avoid something, to sort of keep it away, to reject it, renounce it, destroy it, separate it from ourselves. And if we call these two poles desire and aversion, we can see more clearly that they kind of represent the antithetical poles of craving, the desire to possess and the desire to get rid of. Also, you know, reflected again in the Buddha's first sermon. So desire, tanha in Sanskrit, tanha in Pali, it causes suffering by its own nature because it's kind of inherently unsatisfactory. You know, in that sense, desire kind of means deprivation. To want something is to feel you lack it, to be deprived of it. You know, we don't want the things we have, we only want the things we don't have, those kind of feelings. Thirst is the desire for water, and it occurs in the absence of water. Hunger is the feeling of lacking food, and desiring means not having, being frustrated, suffering. So craving is suffering. And it's quite a really important insight of the Buddha's, and one which we drive into secrecy by our refusal to acknowledge it, and then set out creating the, if you like, esoteric knowledge we try to seek. So to reiterate, the ignorant dualistic mind, avidya, actively mistaking or misperceiving appearances for reality, clings, craves, or thirsts. So tanha, the eighth link of the 12 links of dependent origination, passion and aggression and delusion result. They're kind of movements in thought provoked by habitual patterns of behavior. And this is the immediate cause of the suffering, but the root and fundamental cause is the ignorance. If you could cut the ignorance off at the root, then you can most effectively bring about the cessation of suffering according to the teaching of the Buddha. So there's a way of understanding suffering, dukkha, as the result of failing to understand that things don't exist in the way they appear to us. They're not permanent, not concrete and solid, and not independent in the way we actively assume they are. And failing to see that can also be seen as a failure to really properly understand the Four Noble Truths. You know, ignorance is, in this sense, is the opposite of understanding that the person or other phenomena actually lacks any intrinsic or inherent existence. That's, you know, existence solely from their own side. And those who are affected, us, for the most part, by this ignorance, then generate actions which precipitate us further into the kind of suffering aspects of worldly existence. So the source of our problem is this sort of ignorance. And our senses contribute to that. Our seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, all of these things kind of appear to exist in the way they do appear, and also exist in their own right. And one of the biggest obstacles to understanding and having a good knowledge of the processes at work and the current conditions upon which they work could be labelled, you know, our old friends, I, me, mine. Personal bias is a kind of a huge problem. It's an extreme example is that of the person who suffers from paranoia and assumes that they know everyone and everything is kind of out to get them. And as a result, they interpret everything that happens to them in the light of that. But if we're genuinely kind of seeking self-knowledge, realizing and manifesting being as we really are, it would be of immense value to be able to kind of sidestep personal biases, to get over them, and to develop an ability to interpret events in a more kind of interdependent or intersubjective light, you know, somewhat freer of personal bias. And accepting that there's no absolute kind of God's eye view or inherently existing concrete permanent reality, unaided, this seems quite a difficult thing to do because, you know, we tend to see what we see and think what we think, as it were. And the way to do it is not by withdrawing the mind from disturbing objects or trying to get away from or escape attachment and aversion, but to actively engage with it and realize that objects don't exist in the way that we assume they do when we mistake appearances for reality. So if we can realize that things don't exist in and of themselves as they appear independent of mind, then even if they continue out of habit to appear that way, we can know that they don't. And in that sense, as the first part of His Holiness's text on how to see yourself as you really are is trying to point out, the way out of being deluded by, in virtue of ignorance, mistaking things for existing as they appear when they don't, the way out is insight. To have insight into the nature of those appearances is the way to liberation. So we start by appreciating interrelatedness, interdependence, and impermanence. This already starts to soften the boundaries and things start to become a little less black and white and a little less concrete in the way we understand them on the basis of their appearance. So before going any further into an appreciation of interrelatedness and interdependence and impermanence, we can slow down a bit, don't have to rush, and go back and look a bit deeper into the kind of fundamental nature of our habit of mistaking appearances for reality, thinking that things exist as they appear, and assuming, among other things, that they're much more solid and concrete than they actually are. So from a perspective of the teaching of the Buddha, the existence of suffering is neither a necessary feature of the world nor the consequence of a specific fact or story about the past. You know, some people believe there was original sin or whatever it was. But the important thing here from a Buddhist perspective is that this is not some necessary feature of the world or something that was imposed upon us, but it's a perceptual and conceptual error that we make because we're mistaken about the way things exist. So suffering's produced by a wrong view, an active misperception of the world that is now so much a kind of part and parcel of our habitual way of thinking that we're not aware of its sort of thoroughly relative perspectival nature anymore. There's anybody familiar a little with contemporary philosophy, in terms of late 19th, 20th, and into the 21st century, that kind of recent. There's a philosopher called Thomas Metzinger, and he labeled this phenomenon transparent or transparency. He was saying a conscious world model active in the mind, you know, on the basis of brain activity and so on, is transparent to the mind, yeah, if the mind has no chance of discovering that it's a model. One kind of looks right through it, directly onto the mind, as it were. And if we can realize that things don't exist in and of themselves as they appear, independent of mind, even if they continue out of habit to appear that way, we can know that they don't. Again, back to His Holiness's point of insight being the way out. So there's lots of optical illusions, many that you'll be familiar with. And I think I did bring one in here, if I can find it. It's an example. Yeah, here it is. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the Mulalaya illusion. But if I hold it up, can you see that? Have I got it right? I have to try and see myself. Can you see? Ah, that should be it now. Are you familiar with that one? Those two lines are exactly the same length. But because of the optical illusion created by the reversed arrowheads on the bottom one, it appears longer than the one at the top. But if you draw one of those and you say, well, this one, for example, the line is 24 centimeters long, precisely in both cases. So it doesn't change the illusion, does it? The bottom one still looks longer than the top one. But because of what I've told you, or if you'd done one yourself, you would know it's an illusion, because you know that the two lines are actually of equal length. So that's a good example, not only of an illusion where we mistake things as existing in the way they appear, because clearly they don't. One looks longer than the other when it's, in actual fact, two lines of the same length. But also we can begin to realize that as long as we're aware of that, if we know it for what it is, then we don't make mistakes on the basis of it. We say, oh, it looks as if they're the same length, but we know it's not. So that's the sense in which, you know, insight is the way out. So that kind of example of an optical illusion shows that mere intellectual insight that the two lines are the same length doesn't alter the fact that the lower line appears to be longer, but we can at least then appreciate it for what it is. So the illusion shows us that an illusion is not something that doesn't exist, but something that's not what it seems. There's another very interesting philosopher, and I think he was relatively recently elevated to be professor of Buddhist philosophy at Oxford University, a man called Jan Westerhoff. And he's done some very interesting work. I'll put him on the reading list. He reflects at one point in a book of his called 12 Examples of Illusion. What exactly is the sky? The sky is not a thing. Clouds appear in it. And to his, you know, sort of following his reflection, he was sort of saying they might appear as sort of soft and white, like a down pillow, I think was the way he put it, you know, or as thick as a dark wall, sort of stretching as far as the golden sands of the desert when they're illuminated by the setting sun. But they're really nothing of the sort. They're little more than thin air into which they'll soon melt. So the aim of the Buddha's teaching is not just to show that all things are like illusions because the way they appear is different from the way that they are, but to bring about a radical and complete change in the way we perceive and conceptualize phenomena, such that ignorance or avidya is cleared away and the suffering we experience as a result ceases. And I can remember that when we were last doing this retreat live, I was asking people in between sessions when they were wandering around to pay particular attention to the visual sense and to pay particular attention to colour vision. And somebody came back with an example of a chocolate drink, and they were linking it to their preferences in respect of refreshment. And it was a very good example, but I was driven to think, well, there's an even more fundamental one that's more basic than that. And that was the tin, you know, our perception of the tin of drinking chocolate itself. Because if we can realize that things don't exist in and of themselves as they appear, independent of mind, even if they continue out of habit to appear that way, again, we can know that they don't, and insight is the way out. So I was kind of looking, that particular tin of drinking chocolate had a kind of a deep purple colour on the label. And colour vision, if any of you are familiar a bit with the science of perception, it's the ability to distinguish different wavelengths of electromagnetic radiation, basically. So it relies on a brain perception mechanism that treats light with different wavelengths as different visual stimuli, and consciousness interprets them as colours. So the colour-insensitive photoreceptors, the rods as they call them, in human eyes, kind of only react to the presence or absence of light and don't distinguish between specific wavelengths of light. So colour as we see it is not inherently existing in the paper or the label or anything else for that matter. It appears to exist there in a way that it doesn't. Colours are not existing as they appear out there, independent, concrete, existing wholly from their own side. They're synthesized by our minds and brains to distinguish light with different wavelengths. So while the rods give us the ability to detect the presence and the intensity of the light, and thus allow our brain to construct the picture of the world around us, specific detection of different wavelengths through independent channels gives our view of the world an additional high resolution. Red and green colours look near identical shades of grey if you look at a black and white photo. And an animal with black and white vision alone won't be able to make a distinction between a red apple and a green apple. It won't know which one tastes better before trying them both based on colour. So evolutionary biologists believe that human ancestors developed colour vision to facilitate the identification of ripe fruits, which would obviously provide an advantage in a competitive natural world. But why certain wavelengths are paired with certain colours remains a mystery. And the colour we see is an illusion created by our own minds and brains. It's not clear if other animals see colours the same way we see them. It's likely that, you know, due to a shared kind of evolutionary history, other vertebrates kind of see the world coloured similarly to how we see it, but colour vision's quite common across the vast majority of the animal kingdom. Insects, spiders, cephalopods, they're all able to distinguish colours. But what kind of colours do they see? Human colour vision relies on kind of three photoreceptors that detect primary colours, red, green and blue. But some people lack them, or they have an additional one, that detects somewhere between red and green. And obviously, so only having three doesn't limit our ability to distinguish other colours. Kind of each photoreceptor can absorb a rather broad range of wavelengths of light. And to distinguish a specific colour, the brain compares and sort of qualitatively analyzes the data from all three photoreceptors. And our mind and brain does this remarkably successfully. And some of the research indicates that we can distinguish colors that correspond to wavelength differences of as small a measure as just 1 nanometer. So this kind of scheme works largely in the same way, as far as we can understand, in most of the higher vertebrate animals that have color vision. But the ability to distinguish between specific shades varies significantly between the species, with humans having one of the best color distinguishing abilities. But there are many and interesting differences that you can follow up on and amuse yourself with in the quite popular write-ups of the research, sort of thing you might find in New Scientists and so on. So does it mean that those animals can see additional colours unimaginable to us? Well, perhaps yes. Some of their photoreceptors may operate in a rather narrow region of the light spectrum. So they can have four or five sensitive in the green region, for example. And that means that for them, the different shades of green may appear as different as blue and red colours appear to us. And again, the illusory kind of evolutionary advantages of those sorts of adaptations are obvious for an animal living among the trees and grasses, where most of the objects as we see them are coloured in various shades of green. So, apart from employing a different number of photoreceptors to sense light and specific wavelengths, some animals can detect light that we humans are completely unable to see. For example, many birds and insects can see in the UV spectrum. Bumblebees have got three photoreceptors absorbing the ultraviolet, blue, and green regions of the spectrum. So they've got a spectral sensitivity shifted to the blue end of the spectrum. And the ability to detect UV light explains why some flowers have patterns visible only in this part of the spectrum, because these patterns attract pollinating insects, which have an ability to see in that spectral region. So a number of animals can also detect infrared light, the long wavelength radiation emitted by heated objects and bodies. And that ability kind of significantly facilitates hunting for snakes, for example, that are usually looking for small, warm-blooded prey. So seeing them through IR detecting receptors is a great tool for slow-moving reptiles. And the photoreceptors kind of sensitive to the IR in snakes are not located in their eyes, but in pit organs located between the eyes and the nostrils. The result's the same. The snakes can color objects according to the surface temperature. So we humans can see and analyze only a small portion of the visual information available to other creatures. And it's often worth thinking the next time you see the humble fly, think about how differently it perceives the same things you are both looking at. So I was kind of hoping this, we can go a long way here, and we're only going with one aspect of one sense. You can explore all of the senses in this way. I kind of hope that it's a sufficient example, considering just one aspect of one sense, to kind of challenge the notion that things exist as they appear, inherently, independently, out there from their own side, rather than being something that manifests as a result of a complex causal conditionality and high relativity. Yeah, without all of that coming together, it's not possible that the phenomena we experience as colour could occur. But is it, as it appears, actually in the objects we see? Clearly not. And you can start to begin to explore how the rest of our senses and mental consciousness are similarly affected, if you like, but many of the phenomena we experience, when we start to look, when we start to research, we begin to understand that they don't exist in the way that they appear. So we can even create the illusory experience of something that's not there. So this is something that's much easier to do if we were live together in the same room. But if you, for it, you might want to try it on your own. If you get a piece of A4 paper like that, and at the bottom of the paper on one side, put a black dot with a pen, maybe draw a star or some other shape on the other side, hold it about 18 inches away from your eyes, focus on the black spot and bring the paper slowly towards the eye. At some point, the black spot will disappear. And why that's occurring is because there's a blind spot in our visual fields. There's one on the other side too, and others, but that's a way of identifying one. And it's a way of testing to see if a person's blind spot is, you know, normal, larger, smaller, whatever. And you can do it for yourself sort of quite easily. And that's quite remarkable because you think, oh, well, the entirety of my vision as I see it appears to be continuous. I'm not aware that there is a blind spot, but we can demonstrate that there is. So again, it kind of appears to exist in a way that it doesn't, have a continuity that it doesn't really have. But there's an even more remarkable one that shows you how the mind projects, because when you bring that back and say, ah, yes, the little black spot has disappeared because there's a blind spot. But interestingly, you don't see a hole in the paper. Why? Because the mind and the brain are filling in the gap to say there should be continuous paper there. So we're going to see it that way. But in actual fact, to that part of the visual field, there's nothing. So although the black spot disappears, there's still the illusion of a continuous sheet of paper. So it's fascinating the way you can demonstrate that things that you may have taken as being much more solid, concrete and given than you could have thought are really appearances that don't quite exist in the way that they appear to us. So that kind of blind spot illusion demonstrates that we're not aware that there are parts of the visual field with which we can't see, and that the continuity of our field of vision is a kind of convenient fiction or illusion created by a combination of the mind and the brain. And there are similar analogues covering all the other senses. So to be present to your own experience, study illusions a bit when you get the chance, and to look into some of the contemporary neurosciences and cognitive science to understand more about the nature of our experience can be very, very helpful in getting to conviction, you know, from skepticism to conviction, when Buddhist philosophers are telling us things don't exist in the way that they appear. If you make this sort of investigation, it's a way of proceeding from either suspending judgment or being skeptical about it to reaching some sort of conclusion, to have some conviction, yes, it is like that because I can demonstrate it, I can see it, or I can read the research of people that have been able to make this clear to us, as it were. So what we'd kind of inferred from the ideas and analogies that we've been looking at so far, that things kind of don't exist in the way that they appear to us, can be challenged. And it could be argued that the illusions we've discussed maybe are the kind of rare and isolated cases. So, yeah, so you know, There are all these interesting things, Roy, but our perception of the world is, in fact, more or less the way the world is, never mind these kind of, rather interesting anomalies that you've discovered. But if we dig a bit deeper, then it's also worth noting that we've got a fairly firm conviction in the continuity of consciousness. But in the same way that we think our visual field is continuous in a way that it's demonstrably not, similarly, there's more than enough evidence to try and demonstrate that the continuity of consciousness, although it appears that way, is demonstrably not continuous in the way that it appears. So it could be said here that the kind of spatio-temporal continuity of our consciousness is something of a grand illusion, a kind of a fundamental magic trick played upon us by our own mind. So go back to our visual preoccupations. It's tempting to infer from the screen-like nature of the retina that there's also some mental screen on which mental images are projected. But to consider the screen-like nature of the retina, it does have blind spots. And in addition, the resolution isn't uniform. In the center, the resolution of our vision is about 10 times higher than in the rest of the field of vision. So why doesn't it appear to us as if it's clear and focused in the middle, but blurred and fuzzy around the edges? It's simply because our eyes are not stationary, but continuously moving. Slight, very small movements, tracking objects, jumping around, minutely shifting and moving, even when we focus on something with a steady gaze. It seems as if we're taking in all of a visual scene at once, but what's actually happening is our eyes are subtly, constantly shifting between its different parts. So the temporal continuity of our consciousness appears to rest on a kind of an equally shaky foundation. And we might look at the time-lapse experience when we're driving, especially if anyone does any long motorway driving, you maybe drive 2 or 3 hours and then stop at the services, get a cup of coffee, and while you're over a cup of coffee, you think, well, who was at the wheel? To assume that it must have been somehow other, or that there was some continuous presence there. If you look at it from a logical or a scientific point of view, it would be a bit like inferring that there's a light continuously on in your fridge just because it's always on whenever you open the door to check. But that doesn't constitute evidence that it's on when the door's closed. So these cognitive illusions, I think they're not just rare and isolated quirks. There's a kind of a fundamental illusion that seems to be right at the center of our lives and consciousness, something that we seem to know as continuous, smoothly flowing experience without any holes or gaps, is in fact demonstrably kind of nothing like that. In fact, some neuroscientists might say, well, our consciousness is discontinuous in the extreme, but it doesn't appear to us to be so. It doesn't exist in the way that it appears. And you hear the words of the Buddha, who in the Pali Canon said, consciousness is a magic show, a juggler's trick entire. It may be just like that. And going back to the Pali Canon again, I think another really interesting sutta to look at is the Fena Sutta, Fena or the Foam Sutra. And I'll just do a quote from there. These are words of the Buddha. On one occasion, the Blessed One was staying among the Ayodhyans on the banks of the Ganges River. There he addressed the monks. Monks suppose that a large glob of foam were floating down this Ganges river, and a man with good eyesight were to see it, observe it, and appropriately examine it. To him, seeing it, observing it, and appropriately examining it, it would appear empty, void, without substance. For what substance would there be in a glob of foam? In the same way, a monk sees, observes, and appropriately examines any foam that is past, future, or present, internal or external, blatant or subtle, common or sublime, far or near. To him, seeing it, observing it, and appropriately examining it, it would appear empty, void, without substance. For what substance would there be in foam? Now suppose that in the autumn, when it's raining in fat, heavy drops, a water bubble were to appear and disappear on the water, and a man with good eyesight were to see it, observe it, appropriately examine it. To him, seeing, observing it, appropriately examining it, it would appear empty, void, without substance. For what substance would there be in a water bubble? In the same way, a monk sees, observes, and appropriately examines any feeling that is past, future, or present, internal or external, blatant or subtle, common or sublime, far or near. To him, seeing it, observing it, appropriately examining it, it would appear to be empty, void, without substance. For what substance could there be in a feeling? So the Buddha here is kind of claiming that all matter is insubstantial as foam. Yeah, it's not a bad approximation of how contemporary physics kind of views the constitution of matter, bearing in mind, of course, that they don't really understand what matter is. It's a matter of study and research, but a long way from being resolved or fully understood. So if we go to stuff, you know, any object can be kind of broken down or analyzed into the molecules that constitute it, which in turn break down into atoms, you know, and an atom can be further broken down into a tiny nucleus of protons and neutrons, kind of circled by a cloud of electrons. And at this scale, relative to their size, the distance between the nucleus of the atom and the electrons is astonishing. You know, I can remember when sort of back when I was at school, you know, in secondary education, going to a physics lesson and being astonished to hear the physics teacher quoting the famous physicist Ernest Rutherford. And he was saying trying to locate the nucleus of an atom is a bit like searching for a fly in a cathedral. You know, the electrons surround a tiny bit of matter surrounded by vast amounts of empty space. So those neutrons and protons can subsequently be broken down yet into a further array of subatomic particles. And you look at something like very contemporary, like string theory, that argues that can be further explained by a string, this tiny oscillating loop of apparently around a 10 to the power of 20. That's 100 billion, billion, billion times smaller than the atomic nucleus. And that, as far as we can tell, seems unlikely to be the end of the line. There's an interesting philosophical thought there that maybe ultimately it's not possible to come up with some ultimate constituent or foundation of matter. And that's certainly something that Nagarjuna has been arguing since the 5th, 6th, 7th century in India. So going back for another look, returning to the Phrena Sutta, and relating it to the analogy of our feelings, as the Buddha himself did, it's worth considering that conceptualizing pleasure and pain as two different things might be a mistake because they mightn't exist as they appear. They could be considered as not two different things. One might be considered or regarded as the absence of the other. There's a rather good example of Tsongkhapa in the Lamrim Chenmo, the great exposition of the stages of the path, where he's talking about the pleasure of getting up after meditating for a very long time and speculating, very intelligently in this respect, that what more is the pleasure than the absence of the pain? It's something worth thinking about. And then throughout all of this, we've been talking about the dependent nature of every phenomenon, nothing being independent, nothing singular, permanent, partless, wholly existing from its own side. And Nagarjuna's verse from the Fundamental Wisdom of the Middle Way, because there are no phenomena, there are not dependent arisings. There are no phenomena that are not empty of inherent existence. Because all phenomena have parts, the parts have wholes, and depend on one another. And they appear to seem to have their own entities. But if they did really exist in the way that they appeared, then we should be able to point out a whole that's separate from its parts. But we can't. So there's a kind of a conflict between the way the whole and the parts appear and the way they actually exist. But this doesn't mean there are no wholes, because if wholes didn't exist, you couldn't speak of something as being a part of anything. So the conclusion must be that there are wholes, but their existence is set up in dependence on their parts. They don't exist independently. And again, back to Nagarjuna, that which arises dependently is not one with that on which it depends, and is also not inherently other than it. Hence, it's not nothing and not inherently existent. Dependent or interdependent, there's no other choice. If something's one, it definitely can't be the other. Dependent and independent are a dichotomy. When something can't be independent, functioning under its own power, there's no other option but to see that it's dependent. I mean, His Holiness in his book on How to See Yourself as You Really Are takes a model very famous in philosophy, perhaps to the point of boredom, the example of the table. The table either arises or exists dependently in kind of three ways. It's kind of there in virtue of certain causes, upon its parts and upon thought. So in this case, one of these is the more important factor that designates the object. Existing independence on thought and conceptuality, contemporary physics tells us that the phenomena don't exist in and of themselves. Remember our colour and sound and other examples, but they exist in the context of involvement with an observer. So when I say I, the personal pronoun I can only be referring to something here, this collection of aggregates, this kind of mind-body complex. But if we investigate further, that's all it is, a personal pronoun conceptually designating this. Neither you nor I could come up with something called an I that has its own substance that exists independently from its own side. Nevertheless, here I am, a man, alive, here on retreat, talking about dependent arising and emptiness, etc., kind of sitting, walking, eating, sleeping. So it's sufficient proof that I exist, even if an I can't be found separately from it. The I arises independent on thought, and we can't posit it any other way. There's no question that persons and things exist. The question is how or in what way they can exist. And if you look at His Holiness's book, I think it's page 63, 64. He has a rather nice example there where he says, the point is here that if there were anything truly independently existing from its own side, not dependent on anything else, it should become more and more obvious when analysed. It should be clearly found. But the opposite is the case. Nonetheless, this doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It functions, creates effects, etc. The fact that it's not found when we analyse it and look for it just indicates that it doesn't exist in the way we thought it did. But it appears to our senses as a thing concretely established within itself. Nagarjuna demonstrates that everything is empty of inherent existence. Nagarjuna demonstrates that everything is empty of inherent existence of this sort by the very fact of dependent arising. They're not empty of inherent existence because they are here functioning, but because they all arise and exist dependent upon causes and conditions. Okay, it's 16:29 with a kind of a minute or so to go. So it's a good place to stop. It's also a good place to stop in where we're going on this journey in the retreat. But there's a meditative reflection that's worth thinking about. So as you go forward cultivating your shamatha and your shamatha without an object, when you've got some attentional balance and stability and a little serenity, see if you can reflect on some of this, you know, thinking, well, dependent and independent are a kind of a dichotomy. It's a kind of a division or a contrast between two things that are represented as being opposed or entirely different, that anything that exists is either one or the other. And they're kind of dependence and interdependence are relative both to one another and in relationship to other things. That we can be more or less dependent on things to a greater or lesser degree, but there's no absolute inherently existing dependence or interdependence. You know, recall that kind of mereological example, you know, the idea that anything exists wholly independent on its own, not dependent on anything at all, singular, permanent, partless, completely self-sufficient, is a rather fantasized notion of existence. And we might begin to realize that nothing exists or actually could exist in that way, that when something is dependent, it's got to be empty of being wholly under its own power. So nowhere in the parts of the body and mind that form the basis for us to use the personal pronoun I can we find anything that this refers to that's in any way separate from them, you know, not in some way dependent on them. Therefore, you can kind of find yourself coming to the conclusion that the I is not kind of established under its own power by itself from its own side, but kind of arises and exists independence on and through the force of other conditions, you know, its causes, its parts and thought. So that would be when you've got a moment and you've sitting comfortably in shamatha and want to begin a little reflection, you start to think about the self. What are its causes? What are its parts? What role does thought play in it? Just gently. Keep the emphasis at this stage on the shamatha and just do a little analysis in that way. Don't sort of go too far, too quickly. And then when you've done a bit, just stop, let it go, rest back into the shamatha and see what sort of experience you have. So that's enough from me, I think. At this stage, I'll say, I haven't really got the time to do a reasonable Q&A But if you have a think and reflect and kind of absorb some of that, maybe we can start tomorrow morning session after prayers with some questions on it. Okay.
Thank you, Roy.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Do you want to do dedication prayers?
Yes, please. We do short dedication. That'd be great. Good to do.
I'll just share them.
Thanks for that, Steph.
Okay. There you go.
Thank you. So just coming back, letting go of anything we may be hanging on to, whatever we thought or became wonderful and significant for a moment or not, as the case may be, it'll still be there when you want to go back to it. So just let it go. Come back to the body and the experience of the five senses. Pick up the breath. Allow things to settle into the natural state, and in that quieter space, kind of dedicate by turning over, by giving away whatever benefit we feel we've got, by coming together, making the retreat, meditating, listening to and engaging with the Dharma, and turn it over, give it away, cultivating the first perfection of a bodhisattva, the first paramita, generosity, giving it away and dedicating it so that it might be of benefit to all sentient beings by wishing that bodhicitta and emptiness might arise in those mind streams where they've not yet arisen, and that where they have arisen, that they don't decline but increase more and more. Chang Chub Sem Churin Poshe Ma Kirpanam Kirgujing Kirwanyampa Mepayang Gong Ne Gong Du Pelwa Jo Honi Tawa Rinpoche Ma Kirpanam Kirgujing Kirpanyampa Mepayang Gong ne gong du pelwa jo. Thank you very much. Wonderful to see you.